Thank you for coming back year after year to the Sea of Faith Conference. It's like a family reunion type of exercise. And thank you for giving me the opportunity to chair the panel discussion. We get some of the world's best speakers at our disposal, and I can tweak their brains and get them to talk with each other. This is my 19th panel discussion, and I'm thoroughly enjoying it. Let's open with some reflections on the conference theme by the outgoing chairperson, Laurie Chisholm. In a recent newsletter, he wrote, "In recent times, religious concepts, sin, grace, forgiveness, salvation, have become increasingly empty and meaningless. Even the most fundamental concept, God, is under threat. Cosmology has no need of a first cause. Psychology, no need of a soul. Morality, no need of a divine command to establish right and wrong. In past times, a shared religious faith and practice have served to build communities, linking often very disparate individuals. How will community be fostered in a world in which traditional religion, at least in the West, is collapsing? That's what we met this weekend to ask. The Sea of Faith Network in New Zealand is a non-sectarian, non-dogmatic forum which discusses options about the direction in which our ailing religious life might go in the light of revolutionary ideas by innovators, four of whom are here today. In his opening address, Lloyd Gearing set the scene in terms of where we have come from and where we might be as a species heading. Lloyd described our religion and our society, and if it's not too audacious, our future, as like a basic tribal instinct remaining in all of us and coming to expression, for example, in our loyalty to a sports team or our pride in our city or nation. On Saturday morning, Michael Benedict traveled by cyberspace, hi Mike, a mixture of video files and Skype to give us a working definition of God. With scrupulous detail, he showed us that humans make God rather than God makes humans. I guess we could probably split the room on that one and say, go that way or go that way. This thesis might satisfy both liberal religious people and liberal skeptics. He gave us a look, Michael gave us a look at what might be thought of as a post-theistic replacement for theism. Yes, God does exist, but as the good we do. God is not in his heaven, but rather in our actions and in our language. Welcome back, Michael. Greta Vosper illustrated where religious developments in the form of such trends as progressive spirituality and progressive Christianity might be taking us. More importantly, she proposed why. In brief, creeds are out, deeds are in. And Jeff Troughton this morning put us on our feet, put our feet right back on the ground with a description of the religious state that we in New Zealand are in. He must be credited with the biggest understatement of the weekend when he said, clearly, religion and spirituality is in a place of extraordinary transition at the moment. Don't we know it? We in the Sea of Faith are both contributors to that transition and witnesses of it. We feel comfortable with discussions about the deinstitutionalization of religion and the disaffiliation of churchgoers. It's not so much that religion is going away, but that it is changing its location, its organizational structures, and even the metaphors in which it is expressed. They are changing in a rapid and substantial way. Lloyd, aren't we fooling ourselves in saying that we have a global human community? Consider just at our time Syria, ISIS, the US presidential election. It's rather that the expression human community is merely a poetic aspiration than it is unlikely to be fulfilled in any widespread way. After all, Homo sapiens achieved dominance not by being Mother Teresa, but more like Trump, Putin and Lucrezia Borgia. For at least 95% of human existence, our tribal antagonism was an evolutionary filtering tool which developed humans who were lean and mean. Yes, we were loyal to our genetic in-group, but ferocious to strangers. Then, as now, the gentle went to the wall. Is that so?
You ask whether the present state of the world suggests we are moving towards a global community. I believe they are. I believe we're much closer to a global community in the 21st century than we were at the beginning of the 20th century. And it is expressed in the way in which the nations of the world have united in establishing the United Nations. Of course, the present disturbance in the Middle East does not augur well for the immediate future. But if that had happened 100 years ago, we would all be involved in a major war. We have not had a major war for 70 years. And the reason is that the human species, in all its diversity of nations and religious traditions, is much more concerned today in retaining and nurturing good relationships between the nations and are beginning to think globally. We would not think globally in 100 years ago, except insofar as the British Empire was almost dominating the whole world. Empires have collapsed, and individual nations now, by participating in United Nations, can each make a contribution towards a global community. That is how I see it, and I feel quite hopeful of that, that in spite of the interruptions such as we have in the Middle East, we are moving towards an ultimate goal.
So would you like us to look on these perturbations as the birth pangs of a better world?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Well, we've been suffering birth pangs for quite some time,
yes.
really. And one has to look over a long period in order to see the change that has taken place. We're all globally, I'm talking about us here. We are all globally conscious today, in which our forebears were not before. We used to think nationally or empirically. You know, the British Empire, the sun never sets on the British Empire. I was brought up feeling that. I've had to leave that behind. And I think that is that what I have felt is continually more widely shared.
Thank you. Well, I now want to switch to Michael. Michael, are you there? Can you hear us?
And
splendid. Michael, the founding myths of the Jewish people were like a contract between an inwardly looking tribal people and a strong arm protector. Their requirements for justice and emotional foundations have always called for a strong God, a mighty fortress. Would theopraxy be an effective substitute? You say that God is neither omnipotent nor omniscient.
Yes, let me just say to Lloyd, I'm sure he's read a book by Steven Pinker, I forget its title, in which he proves more or less empirically that the 20th century was the least violent century in human history, including both world wars. A smaller percentage of the human population was involved in war than ever. His argument is that indeed a more peaceful world awaits us than ever before. It's true that I think the birth of the Hebrew nation involved a God who was a protector, who with a strong and outreached hand and a strong arm took the children of Israel out of Egypt and so forth. But the other message that is inherent to Judaism is that Jews are supposed to be a light unto nations. They were asked to be exemplary, and I think that Jesus took that message and took it further than the Jewish establishment at the time could have. So in many ways, for me, both Jewish and Christian religions are both messianic but also evangelical, and they are about spreading the word. And that's very much an outward-looking mission. So I see that as much as the strength image of protector.
I'm looking, though, to contrasting that strength and protector image with the very gentle image that you that your theocratic God exhibits.
Well, I think in time, that sort of imagery, the gentle, transformative, the evolutionary, the voluntary, the existential, will come to prevail.
Good. I think we'll now switch to Greta. Greta, we must concede that definitions of God are many, but don't we run into contradictions when we look for a non-theistic God, as your critics accuse you of? Your approach seems to marginalize the entity Yahweh or God or Allah and to ignore the Pauline Christ. How can what you promote still carry the label of Christianity?
Thank you. While I may diverge from the traditional understandings of Christianity, I'm not trying to undermine them. I think that there are many ways in which they contribute beautifully, gracefully to the human community, and should be encouraged to do that, to continue to do that where they do. Where they do not, I think we need to continue to condemn them, as we have been doing all along. I think that my community, members of my community, would identify some as believers and theists, many as non-theists, and probably a large proportion would not want to be identified as anything, some as atheists. But the work that we do, where we do it, is deeply rooted in the Christian tradition. So we participate in the great festivals, the seasonal festivals of the church. We don't use the traditional language, and we don't ground those traditions in exclusively language and story, but the human elements that were lifted up in the Christian stories are again lifted up, and so we're coming back to those same rooted traditions. So yeah. I think that the community that I currently serve is very strongly an iteration of Christian community. Indeed, had the Christian tradition allowed itself to be influenced by scientific knowledge, anthropological study, the developments since the Enlightenment and before, I think the community at West Hill would be very much in the middle of the road in terms of Christianity.
So is it that the Christianity as it's been traditionally defined, passing away, and something new, with perhaps even a new name, is coming into birth?
I think that some of the statistics that Jeff shared with us around New Zealand society, which are reflected in many other developed societies around the world, where there's a rise in a number of people who are unaffiliated or have disaffiliated with religion, that group will find ways to cohere and to create community that will be outside of what traditional religion has been. Will they cohere around the same values that some of those traditions have come together around? I think that they will. But I think that the term religious might wane. I don't think, however, that we have come to a point in time where we can say that we live in a post-theistic age, as Lloyd was saying when he spoke. I think we still live in a very theistic age, and I think that theism is very often used as a weapon of mass destruction, and we need to address that very clearly, particularly those of us who come out of that or are still in that tradition.
How does the name Savior Christ play in West Hill?
It doesn't. We don't use that language. We talk about salvation. We are one another's salvation.
Yes.
And we are the light of the world, as each individual in this room is. We have the opportunity to be light or to fracture light. And we call ourselves to be light in the way that we were called to be in the gospel. So in that way, we are part of that. But we don't use that language. And Lloyd didn't mention in his presentation, he didn't use the term Christogenesis, which Teilhard de Chardin uses in his Phenomenon of Man. But I think that the principles that he was speaking about when he talked about Christogenesis are exactly the principles that we engage and uplift in our community.
Jeff, you'll start off at 10. You suggested that many formal connections with religious institutions are fraying, while conceding that the religious impulse, even in relatively secular New Zealand, continues to exist. Michael Benedict used the terms existential and made references to Buber. Is this the kind of thing that's continuing to exist?
I'm getting a sense of how your role works, Noel. You're and where we fit. Look, I think that the shape of people's religious and spiritual commitments is very complex. There's a bunch of folk traditions. There's a bunch of legacies of partly remembered Christian stories and narratives, celebrations. There are inventions of spiritual ideas. There's a potpourri of traditions that people are drawing upon. I don't know that people read Buber very much now.
They ought to.
But none of my students would know who Buber is unless I told them. But that sense of interest in I and thou and that kind of relationality would be important, nevertheless.
Yes. And in fact, Greta, is that not the basis of the I-thou relationship is far more important than any institutional treating of people as though they were its?
We're good now? Yes? Okay. I just had an interesting conversation with one of the conference participants about I-thou and how my understanding of God is embodied in that, not embodied, but is in that relationship. So my understanding of God when I used the term was about what it is that we create between the I and the thou or the I and the it. And we can create that which is beautiful, that, you know, offers compassion, that raises up dignity, that honors the other. And that which we create is what I called God. So, and it has an incredible power that we can draw on when we are far distant from the person, or if the person has even died, we can use that power in our own lives. And so that's a very important thing. So I think that theology has certainly informed what we do.
Lloyd, that's a strongly Buber thing, isn't it? The I-thou is the essence of spirituality.
Martin Buber really supports Greta, because Martin Buber, starting off with the importance of the real personal relationship I-thou, which means a reciprocal relationship between two persons, then goes on at the end of his famous classic I and Thou, talks about where there is community starting with three people, where the I and thou is being experienced in a community, there is the divine presence. And indeed, by establishing community, we are, to use Greta's term, creating God. The divine presence is something that emerges out of our personal relationships.
Michael, this is all very, as I say, Jewish.
I like it.
Yeah. And then even the notion of theopraxy, doing things rather than uttering things, very Jewish too.
I have to say, when I was asked to consider the theme of this conference about community, I was, as I'm sure you were, and all the speakers were, and not all community is benign community. There are crime gangs, biker gangs, criminal circles, prisoners. There are lots of communities that are quite unsavory. So the identification of people with each other, or loyalty, or brotherhood, is not itself a guarantee of ethicality, nor of a religious spirit. We tend to use the word community as a kind of a code word. In North America, we never use community, right? I mean, it's not the same in Canada. But if you start using the word community, you're generally talking about African Americans or Hispanics. Rich white people don't live in communities. They live in their neighborhoods or geographic features, like hills and valleys. So community itself, I don't think necessarily sparks or embodies the divine spirit. Unless you sort of surround that with a particular kind of humor. I will also add one more consideration. I like very much that Lloyd used the number 3. Did Jesus not say, where 2 or more are gathered in my name, there am I? But there is a difference between 3 people and 30 and 300 and 3,000. When communities grow beyond a handful, almost beyond family size, they start to invent rules and protocols, and it begins to creep in to the relationship between people. And I think that keeping the idea of I, you, I, thou, is also a way of saying, do not let your communities grow too large, until they are more like a corporation or armies, because that's not community.
Jeff, you might be able to unpack this a little for us. The political history of the West was dominated by formalized Christianity from the 4th century right up to the 19th century. I'm telling you things you already know, I hope. Was the leadership that the church gave to community, because remember the theme of this conference talks about the beneficial or otherwise effects of religion on community. Was the leadership provided by the church beneficial? Or was it a benefit we had to pay for by a form of sort of enslavement almost?
I'm just a humble guy trying to talk about some trying to talk about a few little statistics in New Zealand.
Oh, okay, right.
Look, but therein I think lies the nub of one of the problems that we talk about the church and about Christianity in these total kind of ways. Christianity, even the long Christian tradition, is diverse. It's not just a Western Christian tradition. There's African Christianities that are very old. There are Orthodox Christianities that are different to Catholic and Protestant ones. And so I think breaking down that grand narrative of the church and what it did and whether it was good or bad, in some ways I don't think those kind of categories get us terribly far.
Yeah, but those categories thought they were it. You know, the Roman Catholic Church was the church. It wasn't just a church you might like to come along to. It was the only church in town.
And it structured itself politically in ways that just are very different to the way that Christianities look in most parts of the world now. And it did offer... the political nature of the church was just very different, and it offered an alliance with princes and kings, it was kind of different. I think it did offer stuff. It offered law, it offered regulation, but it also offered power, and it offered the sword, and it offered coercion in ways that we mostly feel pretty uncomfortable with now, I think.
Okay. Well, here's a theme that both Lloyd and Greta can respond to. About a year from now, we in New Zealand anyway, no, the whole world actually, will celebrate both the 500th anniversary of Luther's confrontation with the church that he was a committed member of, and we'll celebrate the 50th anniversary also of a set of events in New Zealand that have come to be known as the Gearing Heresy Trial. Even now, it seems that Greta is being hung out to dry on similar charges. How do fellow heretics get on together?
Okay, now, great, thank you. Lloyd has been a mentor to me intellectually in terms of his work. He has offered the kind of work that my congregation has grown from, and those who were concerned that we were heading out of Christianity found themselves continuing inheritance from Christianity through Lloyd's work, which has been very, very important. So I think what he has been through, I just find it stunning that 50 years later we're going through the same bloody thing. You know, like I find that shocking, particularly in the denomination that, you know, if this was happening in the Presbyterian Church of Canada, I might say, oh yeah, okay. But it's the United Church of Canada, which is the most progressive denomination in the world. So I think there is something happening in that to which we need to be attentive and find ways to protect those who may be vulnerable as a result of whatever the nature of the beast, which you would probably be able to define better than we could, whatever the nature of the beast may be. And if we can identify that and address it, that would be very helpful. Because I think community, contrary to what Michael said, people don't belong to neighborhoods. People belong in communities.
Yeah.
And I think that we need to expand that. And we also can't place upon communities an understanding of what creates a divine community, because some of those gangs and the individuals in those gangs, they belong to one another.
Okay.
And they may not interact with those outside of their gang in ways that we would consider appropriate, but they will die for one another in a way that we would be proud to do within our own communities.
So was Michael using a sociologist's term when he talked about community, and you're using a more spiritually laden term?
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, Michael, you're okay.
Okay, Lloyd, you had something. Well, on the community, and in heresy. Yeah, yeah.
Two former heretics combined. There's other fact when John Robinson, honest to God fame, when John Robinson, honest to God fame, visited New Zealand and we met. He greeted me as a fellow heretic. You mentioned in your introduction Martin Luther and then went to me. I don't want to compare myself with Martin Luther, but we lived in two different eras. And of course, I fully identify with the protest which Martin Luther made. It was a protest against the domination of the person by the authoritative church. And he stood for the position in which he had a personal relationship with the divine, irrespective, as it were, of what the church said. And in doing so, the whole Protestant movement carried carried us a stage forward into the freedom to be experienced and by the individual person. So that up until then, the church, the people were expected to be clones of one another and not able to express their own individuality and personality. Well, gradually, since Luther's time, we've developed that capacity to be our own selves more and more. And the Enlightenment took us another stage forward where we were free to think for ourselves. That's all that free thinker means. We're all free thinkers today in the Western world. Free, even if we ally ourselves with a fundamentalist group, we do it freely. We don't have to. And so there's a sense in which the freedom to become oneself as one sociologist said, made us all heretics in the 20th century.
Yeah. How can, Greta, how can churches foster community if their practitioners don't toe the line?
What line are you referring
well,
to?
Well, like every church has, a line. It has a way we do things around here. It has manuals of what is permitted and not permitted.
Well, then that's the interesting thing, because the United Church didn't have that, right? We haven't had that line until 15 months ago, 18 months ago, when they drew the line. And I think one of the things about the 500th anniversary and the 50th anniversary and the reality that's happening right now is that, I actually see myself as Andreas Karlstedt, who was Luther's practitioner. I mean, Luther wrote all this stuff out, and Karlstedt started doing it. And then Luther came along and said, wait, I didn't want you to actually do that. So that's who I am. I'm just doing what the United Church has long said that it is. I'm just putting it into practice.
Okay.
And it's now saying, whoa, we didn't really want you to say that to anyone. So I think that, like Lloyd and like Luther and like what West Hill is doing, it's just another day. Mike Ouse, the founder of the Oasis Network, pointed that out to us a few weeks ago, saying when you hit these moments in time and these moments in history where things shift and change, no one is doing it intentionally. No one steps out to change history. It's just another day.
Yeah. But I was thinking more of denominations that have a strict rule of the way they do things. I'm thinking of the Anglican Book of Common Prayer.
Yes, and we've had, the Canadian Centre for Progressive Christianity existed for 10 years,
yes.
Introducing progressive concepts and providing resources for groups and individuals across the country. And we always had very little to hand to the more sacramental traditions.
Yeah.
Because they were caught in this top-down hierarchy of form, right? And they needed to use those particular forms. And we had much more freedom in the United Church of Canada to do, I could create whatever I wanted in terms of a gathering community and the norms and the rituals and symbols that were significant to it. They couldn't do that so much. And I think that the communities that did have permission from their bishop to do experimental liturgies, that permission has been retracted, so that they may have operated for 15 years with very progressive language and not having to read the creed, or one priest would stand up and say, okay, now we're going to recite the creed and you're welcome to not say any of the parts that you don't believe. And so there'd be like these whole gaps of silence, and then it would start up again. Well, that's now been, in many of those places, that's been limited now.
It's
so
like reading a Shakespeare play, isn't it? Sort of come into the light and then back into the dark again.
Yeah, very good, yes. Yeah.
There is a possibility, there's a kind of accusation against you, you're probably aware there are many of them, but the trouble that you've got into is an employment problem. Your employer contracts you to do something, and you're not doing it. How well does that fit in the scheme of things?
legally, it fits into the scheme of constructive dismissal because I've been doing this for 15 years with no reprimand. We've had one visit from our overseeing body who checked us off as, you know, absolutely okay, despite all of our documents showing very clearly where we were. I've published two books publicly, and they've been read by many people, and no one has said anything. So if you have 15 years or 25 years of work in an environment, and you've been open and honest for more than half of that about the way that you're presenting it, and then they come along and change a rule that means you're now outside, that's a legal situation, which is identified as constructive dismissal. Well,
I now must change the emphasis to go to some of the questions that you folks have asked. I couldn't handle them all. I've clumped some of them together. And the first one, Michael, what is your definition of the word good as you use it in the title of your book?
One of the chapters in the book says I can't say God is the good you do without saying what my definition of good is. My definition of good is that which honors, preserves, and promotes all forms and instances of life.
Any advance on that from our folks over here?
Preserve, honor, and promote all forms and instances of life.
It has to be recognized that all values come from the human condition, and that there is no such thing as an absolute good. What is good is what the human species judges to be good, and that's all we can actually say. All our values are humanly created values. I'm sure Michael will agree with that.
Yes. Michael, all values are human values?
Yes, but we have the capacity to extend lifefulness to other creatures and all forms of life.
So we've got an idea of what it is.
There are obviously dilemmas when human life is lived at the expense of other creatures, or the life of other creatures is lived at the expense of us. This is not a definition without difficulty. It is simply a definition that says goodness is about the thriving of life on earth with the minimum amount of suffering.
Okay.
Well, there is a difficulty there if you take all forms of life. First of all, we feel we have the right to kill bacteria which affect us. Not only bacteria, we feel we have the right to get rid of rats and vermin and all sorts of things, because nature is such red and tooth and claw, it does not acknowledge that any kind of value, because when an animal has to prey on another animal to live, the whole question of good and evil tends to break down. And we humans have, because of what we are and what we have come to see and expound as values, have worked out a value system that initiates with us, but now, as Michael wanted to say, extends, of course, to the animal kingdom, but, of course, with limits.
With limits. And I remember 50 years ago watching Walt Disney movies, like The Living Desert and so on, where some creatures were given the good guy parts and others were given the bad guy parts. Yeah. This one came from Graham Hill. He says, would you please explain how the idea of God as the good we do can be used to make judgments on difficult moral issues such as voluntary euthanasia and abortion? And that was directed to you, Michael. How can we come off the page and bring them to life?
The concept of divinity and goodness go hand in hand. It does indeed become a very difficult question to answer, There are lots of ethical dilemmas, and you just named two of them. I think the principle, you know, the principle I used, there's about a 10-page chapter trying to cover the issues that Lloyd brings up. And it does get difficult because one must have some sort of hierarchy in some kind of scala natura, such that the principle actually becomes a maximizing and minimizing principle, which is one must do what one can to honor, preserve, and promote all forms of life with the destruction of the least. That doesn't mean none at all.
Right.
The notion that God is the good we do allows us to have evolving morality and evolving ethicality, and to say that the image of God evolves with that. So once upon a time, slavery was considered quite ethical. No longer. I take that to be a step forward, not just in human practice, but also in the concept of divinity.
Great,
yes.
Thanks.
I'm wondering, Michael, is God also then, in your construct, is God also then the good that we don't, when contextually we determine that to do a particular thing is not going to be possible for us, is not the wise choice for us? So what others may consider good, the appropriate, like we know what's good and we know what's bad, but we choose not to do the good because contextually we can't. So does that make the bad the good that we haven't done? The God, the bad, that we, you know?
Yeah, in my preferred concept is that the bad is simply the absence of good. It's not a positive force in its own right.
But that's a condemnation,
yes.
Though.
Very often, you're absolutely right. There is good that could be done, but oneself, you yourself, cannot do it. But I don't think that's bad. No, I think if it's an honest assessment that if I try to do good here, I could make things worse, and you don't, then so be it. Is that not what you're talking about?
It's just practical.
Well, I guess it's. No, I'm talking more about in terms of what is good for me personally right now is not to participate in that action which would be good for the community or good for the other, because my context does not provide me the resources to be able to do it. So that, in that, the weight of the good falls to my own self-preservation instead of what would have been good for the community. So is that not also good, even though we have failed to do what would be defined as God is the good that we do?
If you keep that thing going, you're not going to get a decent war going this way.
Not going to get a good night's sleep either.
Yeah.
Greta, I have no answer for you.
Lloyd.
A great conversation about it, though. So.
Lloyd, you wanted to say something. I thought I noticed you wanted to say something.
I agree with a great deal that Michael says, but I don't want to confine the use of the word God to that. That is one of the valuable uses of the word God, but God has the word God has a very another use resulting from what God used to be. God used to be thought of as the creator. We no longer think of that, but in the Western world, the symbol of God played a very important centralizing role. Even when you were puzzled and couldn't think, you would say, only God knows. And God acted in our culture as a kind of trig station, which you used to enable you to survey the land and planet. So that God was, in fact, the symbolic, it symbolizes the unity that you were hoping to be in your own self, and the unity which you saw in the universe. And it's not surprising, therefore, that it was in the monotheistic culture that science actually emerged. It emerged because the belief that there were absolute laws, as it were, in nature. And the first scientist, Roger Bacon, said he was experimenting to try and understand the ways of God. And out of that came empirical science. So that although God is, in my view, not to be conceived anymore as a personal being, God, the concept of God, is very important for, as a unifying symbol of how we see reality.
Yeah, I would. I understand that that was the role of God, and I fear that that role is what is actually draining away.
There's a similar one I'd like to, from core group two, is asking the question, I think Jeff might like to grapple with it, what emphasis or changes in behavior should the remnants of the Christian church promote in the future? I guess the implication is he's talking, or they are talking about the remnants of it. Is that a good term to use, or does your statistics indicate that there is a remnant status turning up?
I'm not sure what the remnant is referencing, but Greta and I were talking about this a little bit earlier, actually, and I think one of the challenges, I think, for people who claim a tradition and who claim to follow a teaching is to live it and to enact it and to, in my view, in a costly way, in a committed kind of way, embody the values they talk about. And live the things that they say are important. And I think this is just a truth for Christians, that if they claim to follow one who says that you should love your enemies and that you should love your neighbour, and that the way of forgiveness and the way of reconciliation is the way of the kingdom, then to actually do those things and to demonstrate in costly, self-giving ways what this looks like, and to experiment and to be willing to risk doing things that look true to those values, even if they don't look true to the way life has been experienced.
Greta, you'd resonate to that word kingdom, I think, as a contrast to the institutionalization of the institutional nature of the church.
Well, I certainly understood what Jeff was talking about, and I would say that that's, I mean, that's that Christogenesis that Desjardins also raised up, and yeah, I think that is what it is that we aspire to. Mm. I wouldn't use the language, that's all.
Yeah.
Like the principles and the values and the potential inherent in that symbol are what we aspire toward,
yeah,
but we just don't use that language.
Yeah, I mean, we don't use the word kingdom nowadays because it brings into the present tense the various unpleasant things of the past. But the sense in which Jesus used it, it wasn't a rival to the Roman Empire, but it was an alternative to it. It was the alternative, in fact.
Yes.
The words like kingdom and the kingdom of God, and all the religious words we've come to use, I don't think should be abandoned. They are everyone's to understand in new ways with every generation. And if Jeff wants to use the word kingdom, if that was his understanding, he has the right, in fact, I think the duty, to insist that he understands something slightly different by kingdom, let's say, than some Orthodox Catholic might be. I don't think we should just be abandoning metaphors, poetics, and the language of religion, just leaving it in a sort of a refuse thing.
And I'm not suggesting that we do that.
And something scientific and modern, not at all.
Yeah.
I think we have to actually redeem religious metaphor, poetry, and language, and say these things mean something different now.
I've seen the kingdom of God replaced with the republic of God. Any better?
No. I think that my argument is not that we need to put the language on the trash heap. I think that that language and those particular metaphors speak to a particular community, and for those for whom they draw them toward those aspirational ideals. Yes. In their relationships, the I, thou, and the development of the power inherent in that, in the development of that relationship, that's very positive and should be preserved and transmitted to future generations. Mm. My concern is there are a lot of people who don't give one hoot about that language, who find it toxic, who find within it inherent patriarchal systems and systems of power and control that they eschew, and they want... They need communities that allow them to reach for those aspirational ideals. And using metaphor and poetry and language to cohere those communities is a task for those who don't use that traditional language, but perhaps a task for those who have been proficient in its use to engage communities in a new way.
But every group with the best intention in the world can offend another group, even without trying to.
Yes, obviously.
Yeah.
And could I say that the key to my observation was less about language than praxis. It was really about doing the stuff that you claim is central to your beliefs and values. And if you don't do it, then you're not, the remnant doesn't really stand for very much. I don't think your language is less important than your language coming to life in the actual embodiment of praxis.
There's a question, a couple of questions here, which net down to the following. Lloyd spoke of Teilhard de Chardin's concept of complexification. The physicist talks about entropy, which goes the other way. Lloyd, how do you square those?
Well, Teilhard de Chardin knew all about the second law of thermodynamics. What he said was that as he observed the evolutionary process, there were in fact two natural energies at work. One was an explosive category, and the other was radial energy, which drew things together. Now, what he said was, you may not agree with this, but he said, tell me a better way of explaining how evolution has taken place. And the real trouble with the law of thermodynamics is that it's not sufficient in itself to explain evolution. It could only explain an explosion in which everything became... when an energy was lost and lost and lost in heat. Why did the galaxies form? Why did atoms join up into molecules? Why did molecules and so on become more complex? And now he tried to describe this with his term complexification. Why does it happen? Yeah. Well, The law of thermodynamics is certainly in conflict with it, but that's something it does not explain.
So this still sits in the in tray waiting for an answer.
Mm.
Yeah. Michael, did you have any thoughts on that?
I've actually written a great deal about complexity. Oh. As a designer, we face it all the time. All the arts have to deal with generating more complexity than can be read or dealt with, or constructed or understood. The mechanism I found most useful to understand that allows entropy to increase as well as order is to realize that entropy always increases. The number of possibilities go up all the time, but the number of actualities goes up at a slower rate. And so even though both are ascending, the gap between them grows, and the gap between the actual and potential entropy is what we call order. So the complexification of the world is actually the second law of thermodynamics. It's the delay or the breaking force, so to speak, that opens up the growth of order at the same time. It's not my idea.
Have you that, Lloyd? It's a bit above my head. It's a bit above my head. I'm going to have to wait for the musical to come out to understand that one. Before we leave complexification and entropy, we must have some forward views as to the way things are going. We start off by saying, is the world getting worse? No, it's in fact getting better, even though some of the signs don't think so. Do we have any sense of optimism at all about where things are going? It's very fashionable to look at the US presidential elections and roll your eyes up to heaven and Syria. So are there any grounds for optimism?
There are grounds for optimism, but there's also grounds for deep pessimism, and they are in two different areas. The grounds for optimism is that I believe we are becoming a more global and harmonious community. But as we are doing so, we have so far been blind to what we are doing to the earth. And the real pessimism comes from the fact we are destroying the very basis on which we live. And that's going to come to a climax in the 21st century. How soon? It's hard to know. But it's going to come, and that's why one has to be very pessimistic about that. Now, it may well be that it is in learning how to deal with the coming catastrophe and how to avoid it that will be the final factor in drawing us humans to work together for the common good.
Lloyd, that's not only a pragmatic observation. I think in the past you've said we must look on the earth as a sacred object.
Yes, in the sense that the long tradition in Christianity was this was a fallen world destined to pass away because it needed to be destroyed and replaced by the heaven above, which was already dominating it. And of course, what has happened is that with the demise of heaven, and the earth is the only part of the universe of which is the place where we live and the only place where we'll ever live, it has now taken on a new kind of sacredness because life depends upon it. And therefore, all our rituals, in my view, which should be directed towards recognizing our place on earth and nurturing our relationship with it.
Greta, I think you had something you wanted to add there.
I did. I'm not much of an optimist when it comes to our identifying the crisis approaching and finding ways to avert it, because I think we're in the crisis and I don't think we can avert it. I think we have to find ways to cope with it. The youngest regular participant at West Hill United Church is a young woman, she's 23. And her body is covered with scars from where she cuts herself and burns herself regularly. Because she, and for me, she embodies all of the pain that the current generations that are older than her have placed upon her generation. You know, there's a lack of hope and a fear of failure. We say we want to avert the coming disaster. That puts it on someone else's shoulders. And I don't think we have the privilege of doing that. I think we need to take responsibility for that now. But I think that in the process of our organization, we went from tribal to religious to national, and we're now organizing ourselves in terms of major corporations and their impact on the earth. And I think that we need to be attentive to that and the devastation that it will continue to wreak upon the earth. And I think we need to stand in opposition to that in whatever ways that we can. And while we're doing that, I think we need to find ways to reach out to one another, because I like to use the word if, but I often think the word when we go down as a species. I want us to go down with dignity, and I want us to go down looking at each other in the eyes and knowing that we hold love for one another and not contempt, and that we will offer everything of ourselves to one another and not try to take from someone, that we will have the courage to honor the entire history of our species as we face that crisis.
Michael, how do you feel about that?
The book I think I've read most in the Bible is Ecclesiastes.
Yeah. Good.
This is the spirit I actually feel closest to. So for me, optimism is a professional stance. I teach architecture. In my tradition, there are Teilhard de Chardin of architecture, might be Buckminster Fuller. There are very heroic visions of what engineering and architecture and positive constructive action can do to save cities from rising oceans, to house a doubling of our population, to the greening of everything. My field is full of utopian visions of collective action executed mainly through physical action, should I say.
You use the term utopian visions. Yes. Are there not also dystopian visions?
There are, and they are equally attractive and more fun.
Yeah.
Is
Greta expressing a dystopian vision or a realistic vision?
No, a hopeful one. Greta's is a hopeful one. From my point of view, I've noticed that nothing makes people turn on each other more like dogs than perceived shortage and competition. And I worry that human character degrades exactly as the relationship to the environment and pressure for resources becomes more difficult. So for me, I think it's prosperity is part of peace, and that we really do have to find creative ways to keep our basic needs satisfied. I think it could easily turn into a dog-eat-dog world. And Greta, I do hope we can go down with the love in our heart. It's unlikely.
Yeah.
If we're going down, we're going to be nasty.
I just said to Jeff, perhaps for your amusement, that those dystopian visions reside in local planning councils.
But also in the news media. I mean, we take every opportunity to kick the news media because it deserves to be kicked. But we get a sour, hysterical view of the world.
You know, there's a tradition. Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah.
There's a tradition, even within dystopian visions, of the sublime. Most of our movies are dystopians,
yeah.
And we are drawn to them magnetically,
yeah.
Because they show opportunities for heroism, for withstanding difficulties, for the triumph of certain values over others, and so forth. All video games are dystopian.
Yeah.
Actually, people are not very interested in utopias.
I think they also form the function for people of our age, where we can tell all our younger people, see, we told you so, it was all going to the dogs. And the news media, yeah, are reeling it out day after day after day, just how bad things are.
So I think we need to, as imaginative people, we need to paint a picture of heaven,